on the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or out of here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Jerry Guidetti from the ARC Institute. But before we get to Jerry, I just wanted to comment briefly on the president's speech this evening. Now, the president says that he wants to have a guest worker program. There's just no way that we can round up illegal immigrants who are here and ship them back. There are too many of them. And the question is, why are there too many of them? Why? Because they very specifically have wanted to create the problem. Now, what should we be doing? Should we be posting National Guard troops on the border? That's simply a cosmetic thing to give you the impression that they're really going to try to do something about the problem. As the president said this evening, it's illegal to hire people who are here illegally. Had the Bush administration enforced the federal laws 5 years ago, we would not now have 20 million illegal aliens here in the United States. But it didn't start with George W. Bush. It started with Bill Clinton. It started with George Herbert Walker Bush. It started during the Reagan administration, immediately after they put in the amnesty program back in 1986. And they promised they'd enforce the laws. They had no intention of enforcing the laws. Why? Because, of course, we have people in our government who have no loyalty to this country. They're globalists. They want eventually to merge the United States with Mexico. They want to convert us into a multicultural, multilingual society. And that's really what it's all about. But you're never going to hear that mentioned. So with that as a background, let's get to Jerry Guidetti of the ARC Institute. Jerry Guidetti, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Jerry, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can certainly hear you fine.
Okay. All righty. It's very interesting you should start out that way, because I thought I might comment on that tonight as well, on the president's speech, because I think it kind of it piques my curiosity that all of a sudden we're taking great interest in this. Now, you look back a year and a half, 2 years ago, and Lou Dobbs on CNN really did an outstanding job, I think, in pointing to the problem of all of the aliens slipping across the border and really swarming into this country in such great numbers that he said, how can you talk about homeland defense, homeland security, when in fact we have a lot of unknown people coming into the country who maybe aren't migrant workers, but who are possibly terrorists.
And that's a lot of those people came in something called the catch and release program. They would catch them. They would immediately release them. Why would you do something like stupid unintentionally?
Right. As a matter of fact, there is a sheriff here in Oregon, Umatilla County, who is basically housing all of these folks in his jail, and not having enough space for any local criminals, because he refuses to catch and release. He is asking Cindy Fox for monies for the losses that he has taken in his system.
I think that I like your sheriff.
Yes, it sounds like he has a strong backbone. Just did see a story on him, and he's quite a special person, I think.
We'll be back in just a moment, but understand, ladies and gentlemen, the people in Washington, D.C., don't want to solve the problem. They want to make all these people legal. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Jerry Guidetti. So, Jerry, pick up the story from there.
Sure. I have to tell you that the fact that we have two things working here. We have, of course, the national exposure on national news to the border problem that I believe began with Lou Dobbs about 2 years ago, and he really brought it to national attention. Then, of course, you have the Congress. The Republican Congress is definitely in trouble in upcoming elections, and so there's a lot of pressure on George Bush to resolve this issue, because there are a lot of angry Americans There are a lot of people, even in Congress, who are concerned about the influx of potential terrorists across the border, plus the loss of jobs to Americans, and so on. So you have those factors. You have the political factors. You have the economic factors. But I cannot help but believe that the reason that this is coming to a head right now, in addition to the elections, is because of the fact that we have in the new national strategy or plan for handling pandemic influenza, we have the border crossings and closings as a potential means of blocking off entry into the United States. If you stop and think, Stan, about what will happen when human-to-human pandemic occurs, which may indeed be occurring right now in Indonesia, I'll talk about that in a moment, that if indeed we get pandemic in Mexico, here in the United States, of course, there's the potential, but let's say we don't have it yet. If we have it in Mexico first, how are you going to prevent those poor people who are infected or fearful of being infected from swarming across the border seeking medical care here in the United States or safety here in the United States? The only way you can prevent it, and this is in the government's own literature, the only way you could prevent it would be to close the borders. How can you close the borders when, in fact, we supposedly haven't been trying to close them before? Well, this sudden interest in putting 6,000 troops on our border and telling Fox, the Mexican president, that this is only a temporary measure, and in the president's own speech tonight saying that it would last approximately a year until other agencies and so on were able to take over and technology was able to be increased. They're looking at drones, for example, airplane drones, to spot these folks coming over the border and so on, until technology takes over.
But, of course, Jerry, the question is, why did they wait until now? They've had well over five years now, to solve the problem. They didn't solve the problem. They didn't try to solve the problem until now when they're trying to get legislation through. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan and Jerry is suggesting that perhaps the reason that they want to put the troops on the border is her fear that there will be a bird flu epidemic, and certainly if there were and you had human-to-human transmission, you would not want the people coming across the border and bring it into the United States. And my point was that I think the reason that the president, at least at this point, is going to post the troops on the border is simply to try to build up his popularity. He's down to 31%. He's got to give the feeling he's doing something. And, they've had 5 years to seal the border, if they wanted to. They don't need to seal the border. All they have to do is stop the jobs. You do that, it's not that illegal immigrants, will take jobs that nobody else will. It is that they will take jobs that pay so low. For instance, Tyson's been able to get the price of meat cutters down from $19 an hour down to $9 an hour. If they were paying a living wage, they wouldn't have any difficulty at all. The reason that the illegal immigrants will work for $9 an hour is they can afford to. That's so much more than they would possibly be able to make in Mexico. And the administration is using the illegal immigrants to grind down the living wage here in the United States. That and to create a multicultural, multilingual society. But right now, of course, I believe, and Jerry, it may be right that if we really did have person-to-person transmission, they would have to seal our borders. But right now, I think the president wants to give the American people the idea he's really going to do something. He's had 5 years to do it. He wants to get this legislation through right now to make all of these people legal. That's what it's really all about, because he has a different vision of what America should be than I think the average person listening to this program. But go ahead, Jerry.
I 100% agree with you, Stan, that there is a huge political motivation here. What I'm saying, though, is I believe that it is not also coincidence that this is occurring at the same time that the government is has tuned up, a massive strategy, a plan for handling epidemic avian influenza, bird flu, or any pandemic influenza here in the United States, and handling the borders. Because when I read large parts of this 233-page document, which has been out for, 10 days, I think, maybe as long as 2 weeks, they have under Chapter 8, Law Enforcement, Public Safety, and Security. This, again, is the government's own document. You can access it on pandemicflu.gov. And when you link, by clicking on the cover of this document, when you link to the document itself, it comes out of the White House's own website. And they're talking about the need to close borders as one means of, an extreme means, but as a means of preventing the influx of avian influenza in the case of flu, and keeping order and keeping outsiders out. But the other thing, Stan, that comes along in the same thinking is it has been suggested in inner intelligence circles that the great fear is once we have human-to-human transmission, that it is going to be used as a weapon of mass destruction. It is going to be used by terrorists. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we have the national strategy come out, say, 2 weeks ago at alongside. Then we had the movie, the semi-documentary movie that came out showing pandemic influenza in a worst-case scenario. Then we come out with, this week, the border security speech by the president. I do believe that there is a connection between all of these. Yes, his ratings are down in the toilet. He has to get them up if the Republicans are to be reelected in upcoming elections in Congress. And yes, I agree with you. This should have been acted upon all in the last 5 years. Why now? That's why I see another facet to this discussion and to this urgency. And that is that it is looking more and more every day like H5N1 or one of its cousins is going to trigger the human-to-human mutations that we have most feared happening. And what happened yesterday in Indonesia, that unusually big cluster, and it has been now published in all the mainstream business press as well, Wall Street Journal in Asia, for example, and Wall Street Journal in America, we have a cluster of 8 family members. Last week, 6 of them died, all H5N1. 2 more are very ill. One of the nurses tending some of the 6 who died is now ill. They have confirmed H5N1 in 6. World Health Organization and CDC and Hong Kong authorities have sent epidemiologists and microbiologists, virologists over to Indonesia, to the Sumatra area, to determine whether or not this has made the mutation. What is particularly concerning about this very large cluster is there are no H5N1 birds in the entire vicinity or region. This family had a few chickens around its property, but none of them were H5N1 positive to their knowledge yet. But what they did have in common is that all 8 of them ate the same pig. And I have told you on this program, I've spoken on other programs, that the major concern we have had is that the final mutation would not happen inside a human, but would happen as most influenzas arising out of Asia do, and that is by mutation through a pig who can be infected by either human, avian, or both simultaneously. The pigs are carrying human-type genes and vice versa, and the birds are carrying gene fragments from pigs and humans. And if indeed this family, this cluster, proves to be human-to-human transmission, it will be the largest cluster of influenza with a human transmission or person-to-person component ever seen. And that's why epidemiologists are swarming down on this as we speak. Again, we have been talking about bird flu and wild bird flu on the wings of birds coming to America and so on, but as I've said on other programs, Stan, it's not likely that the birds are going to be our biggest threat. It's going to be that first mutated strain that is efficiently human-to-human that arrives on a jet plane from Jakarta or from Sumatra or from Vietnam or China to the United States and spreads it. I think there is a connection between the speed with which they are looking to actually close this border and the fact that they're talking, putting 6,000 troops on the border, and the connection to their plan, which I can read your listeners parts of, the federal involvement. While this chapter outlines the types of federal assistance that can be provided when states, territories, and localities need assistance, especially direct law enforcement assistance, planning officials should note that the federal government's ability to provide assistance across the United States will be limited due to relatively small numbers of federal law enforcement personnel available, etc. The ability of military personnel will likewise depend on many factors, including whether such support is feasible in light of other national defense functions being provided at the same time, and the impact of the pandemic on military personnel. They then go into understanding the legal framework, sharing ideas among law enforcement agencies, and so on. But then as they go down, they talk about to prepare for the possibility that assistance from National Guard may be required to supplement local or state law enforcement. And in the case that they're overwhelmed, state and local officials should prepare in advance the processes and procedures for getting the forces that they need. And I'm paraphrasing here. Then they're talking about conducting training and preparedness exercises in individual states, closing down whole geographic areas. For example, geographic quarantine or cordon sanitaire is the isolation of whole localities with documented disease transmission from localities still free of infection. And they go on to talk about introducing the Department of Defense, whose usual place is in military enforcement elsewhere in the world, but they're talking here about the Department of Defense actually being used in law enforcement capacity here in the United States.
And of course, that's a total violation of the Posse Comitatus law, but I guess they really don't worry about the law. You know, if we didn't have all of our National Guard over in Iraq fighting for freedom and Afghanistan, maybe we could use them here, and we wouldn't have to use the military and violate this tradition which has been in place since the time of the Civil War. So I'm really concerned that they have so little respect for the laws of this country.
Well, the exact paragraph on that, especially the fact, as you mentioned, emergency federal law enforcement assistance, the federal government may assist a state in maintaining order at the request of a governor. Now, we saw this in Katrina when they finally brought them in, because the other systems were failing. When state and local resources are overwhelmed and not capable of an effective response, there are two primary ways the federal government can provide assistance. One, providing federal law enforcement and personnel, and two, pursuant to exceptions to the Posse Comitatus Act, 18 U.S.C. 1385, when civilian law enforcement resources are inadequate, by the president directing the armed forces to assist with civilian law enforcement functions.
Well, I'm sure that the federal government has to abide by the law, too. If they want it to repeal the Posse Comitatus law, they should. If the president doesn't like the law, he should repeal it. But the president is not above the law, except, of course, I think there's some people who think he is. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti, and I think we have to be concerned that there are people in Washington, D.C. who have so little respect for the law. Why did they pass Posse Comitatus? Well, for the same reason that back in the time of the Civil War, the federal troops acted irresponsibly, just exactly as they did in New Orleans, going house to house, collecting weapons and making people defenseless in the face of marauding groups. We'll be right back with Jerry Guidetti. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Jerry Guidetti from the ARC Institute, and we're pretty basically talking about the president's plan to station the National Guard along our border, and Jerry thinks that there may be some relationship to this recent outbreak over in Indonesia. Now, Jerry, did they know whether this pig actually had H5N1? Have they checked the pig yet?
All the samples have now been sent off to the World Health Organization's authorized lab in Hong Kong. We're going to be hearing about it soon, I'm sure, but they will be making absolute certainty that that's what it is. I'm very concerned, as are most virologists and other biologists, that we're looking at a very different situation here in Indonesia. Now, we have basically around the world, we've got another big case outbreak in Romania, for example. We have other areas that have quieted down. We're now seeing that the avian influenza is occurring in waves, as we know all pandemics do. And the waves occur not only in birds in waves, it's already pandemic in birds, but now we're starting to see human waves. We have additional cases, for example, in Thailand. Now, Thailand and Vietnam, of all places, have done an excellent job in squashing it after their first and second waves, respectively. But other waves will be forthcoming, as they always are in pandemics. Once it comes human to human, we have to expect those same kinds of waves occurring. And what we're seeing in Indonesia now may, in fact, maybe it's not. Maybe there is a common environmental source. Maybe the common environmental source is the pig. Maybe they all did a pig dance beforehand. Who knows? I'm trying sick humor here. But the point is, what was the exposure to the pig, or what was the exposure to poultry, if indeed it wasn't from eating either? Add to that the fact that we now have two more very important pieces of information, and that is avian influenza can infect the human through the gut. And the first symptom may in fact be diarrhea, severe diarrhea, bloody diarrhea as well. This explains why we have had in several countries diarrhea showing, no tests being done, people dying, and then it goes to multiple organ failure, including encephalitis. And we've had so many cases of children with encephalitis that we didn't realize were H5N1 until after they did autopsies. Complicating the matter is that in Indonesia, they're not allowed to do autopsies. You know, many of these people, religious beliefs, don't let them do it. But we have gut infection, and we also have in Indonesia a death rate, a fatality rate of 78% at this point. The movie showed a 5%. 1918 was a 2.6%. 78% is absolutely unheard of in any human pandemics that we've got any kinds of records on. And so they can assure you, we can assure you that as waves go around the earth, if this goes human to human, they usually get weaker and weaker with each pass. But when you're starting out at 78%, it's a pretty scary thing. So let's keep fingers and toes crossed that what's happening in Indonesia is yet one more example of a cluster that has occurred because there is some common environmental source of infection.
And, of course, let's hope that, of course, that they will be very careful. They will isolate that, and as they have with the outbreaks of Marburg and Ebola and other really terribly deadly diseases,
yes.
If they use standard public health techniques, they can control it, as they did with SARS. They controlled SARS beautifully. Because they did the right logical thing. With AIDS epidemic, they didn't try to stop its spread. And, of course, it's already killed 30 to 40 million people. Let's hope they won't make another mistake.
Well, mode of transmission
with AIDS. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Guidetti. And we were simply talking about that, you know, with this outbreak over in Indonesia, let's hope that the local public health authorities are isolating this, certainly quarantining this, because you can stop epidemics by quarantining that area to prevent the disease spreading to other people. That's how they actually were able to stop smallpox completely, by isolating those people and then vaccinating the people in the surrounding area, until eventually there was just no more smallpox because it has to have a human host. Well, anyway, go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, well, let's take a look at that idea, smallpox and so on. These were at times when people didn't get into their car to go to the store for everything. They were rather self-reliant in their own homes. They did not communicate. We didn't have as many people as we had, as close contact. We didn't have jet travel that took us all over all over the earth within 24 hours. All of this, the border closure, the quarantine, you mentioned quarantines. Yes, quarantines, and that's exactly what I was talking about before, about the use through the national strategy for pandemic influenza. The use of forces from the local police force clear on up to the Department of Defense will be necessary to maintain public law, peace, security, to prevent outbreaks of violence, breaking into store windows. I'm missing the word. Breaking into store windows.
Vandalism.
Yes. And vandalism, so on. They actually are mentioning these as the kinds of behaviors. We saw it in Katrina. They were saying, look at this, people are looting. They're looting stores. Excuse me. There were people starving to death down there. There were people who needed a drop of water to feed to a baby. You might call it looting. If they're running out with armloads of clothes, perhaps it's because they've soiled their own, because there are no toilets, and that was the situation down in Katrina. So, yes, maybe there were folks who were off the beaten track mentally, and they were doing, and they were looting for other reasons, but the majority of people were trying to survive. And here we go again. We're looking at law enforcement to prevent those kinds of situations, and they're looking for civil disorder to be something that will be likely if we get a pandemic with any kind of death rate anywhere near the 1918. So that brings us once again to something I've said a million times over on this program, Stan, and that is folks really ought to take seriously the need to stay out of the line of fire, have the ability to stay out of the mainstream. Social distancing is the term that you're going to be hearing a whole lot of in the early stages of any pandemic, whether it is this one or one that's coming next year or one that's coming 5 years from now. Please be aware that there is a pandemic approximately every 33 years. Sometimes they come back to back. It takes 3 to 4 years sometimes for them to get all the way through a society. But we have about 3 a century, sometimes as many as 4 or 5 a century. We're overdue now. So be prepared in your own home to be able to stay out of the line of fire. You don't have to go loot and look for food for your baby or whatever, because you've thought ahead and you're starting to stock up, as the government is expecting you to, is telling you you had better do. They're trying not to panic you. They're trying to get you to prepare, and they're only talking about 2 weeks' worth, figuring maybe they're going to have enough armed forces, they're going to have enough community organizations, NGOs, and so on, that are going to be able to deliver food and water to individuals. I would say plan for a whole lot longer than that. The virologists, the top virologists in the world, are planning no less than 3 months of supplies.
Well, I certainly agree with you, Jerry. I think people should begin to make preparations to look after themselves. After all, they had FEMA down there in New Orleans that was keeping out the supplies. I mean, Walmart was trying to bring in water and food, and the FEMA wouldn't let them in. People were trying to come there with their airboats and with their motorized boats to help, and FEMA absolutely did everything they could to make things worse. And since they refused to disband, FEMA has been suggested, you better look after yourself, because if FEMA's there, I would be very, very concerned that they would, rather than trying to solve the problem, they would make the problem far worse. And it's because of what FEMA did at New Orleans that many people in Washington, D.C. are saying, we ought to do away with this entire agency. And the response is, oh no, we couldn't do that. Why, we want to expand it and make it more kind and compassionate and efficient. And of course, well, it's pretty hard to make a government agency efficient. When was the last time you ever saw a government agent that you made larger, that was more... So you better start thinking, and I agree totally with what Jerry's saying, people need to be prepared to look after themselves. And I think her plea, and I think she knows she feels this very strongly, is to try to get people to begin making preparations for the possibility that very, very difficult times lie ahead. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Quinetti from the ARC Institute. Go ahead, Jerry.
Back to the national plan for a moment. Another interesting paragraph on how they might do law enforcement during a pandemic. And piggybacking on what you said, Stan, I think largely these agencies are just so big, so disorganized, so diffuse, so fragmented, that it just lends itself to incompetence it lends itself to inefficiencies. People really have to understand that what we're looking at here is Katrina times 1,000 communities at the same time all over this country, possibly coming over the borders because the borders can't be closed and so on. We're looking at a situation where you really can't count on anyone but yourself. And so you should be thinking about it now, whether it comes tomorrow, next week, next year, 5 years from now. But going back to the plan, for example, they say civilian federal law enforcement assistance. Under the Emergency Federal Law Enforcement Assistance Act, 42 U.S.C. 10501, the Attorney General may provide law enforcement assistance, including federal personnel, in response to a governor's written request when he determines that such assistance is necessary to provide an adequate response to a law enforcement emergency. The provisions define a law enforcement emergency as an uncommon situation requiring law enforcement resources that threatens to become of serious or epidemic proportions, and for which state and local resources are inadequate to protect lives or property or enforce criminal laws. To that extent, federal personnel would be used to enforce state or local law. They should be deputized or otherwise authorized under state or local law to exercise the key law enforcement powers, including arrest, search, and seizure involved in enforcing those laws. And then use of military for law enforcement duties, although the primary mission of the DOD, Department of Defense, is defense of the United States, the department may, with the approval of the Secretary of Defense, provide support for law enforcement operations that does not involve the use of law enforcement powers, such as arrest authority. In addition, in certain situations, DOD personnel may be directed by the President, traditionally only as a last resort. Notice the traditionally, and in support of civilian authorities to perform actual law enforcement responsibilities.
Will you hang on there? We're going to be right back here in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and Jerry was simply reading from this new federal report that says under strict circumstances, under severe circumstances, why we would use the military for police activities. And, Jerry, I don't know if you know this, but many of the military leaders are saying, we don't have our men trained for this. Our men are trained for killing. And that is the purpose of the military, not for police activities. We would have to completely retrain the American military, but that doesn't seem to bother the Bush administration, that our military are trained for killing. They want to use them for local police. I would think we would deputize people locally. I would far rather and feel far better if we had local people, here performing these activities rather than our military, who are very efficient in what they do, as the people in Iraq and Afghanistan will tell you. But that has nothing to do with local policing. Well, anyway, before we go on, Jerry, I'd really like you to get your web page out, get your telephone number out so people would know how they can get in touch with the ARC Institute, because you have something that most people need.
Yes, we certainly do. And the website is ARC, A-R-K, Institute.com. All is one word, ARCInstitute.com. If you're not on the computer or you want us to send you information, 1-800-255-1912, 1-800-255-1912. What I would remind folks about the ARC Institute, Stan, is that we are essentially an organization that preserves natural heirloom seeds to guarantee people the right to grow their own food supply, because indeed the global food supply is threatened by companies that threaten to take away seeds from individuals, from whole countries, seeds that can grow your own food year to year. These seeds are being seized. It is a hot topic on the floor of the United Nations. It is a hot topic all over Europe. It is American-based businesses largely who are doing this, taking the rights of people away in terms of growing their own food. And I ask your listeners to think about this impending pandemic again, whether it starts tomorrow or it starts next year or the year after. When it happens, if 50 to 75% of the people around the globe are infected, they're not going to work. Farmers aren't on their tractors. Fertilizers are not being made out of the gas and refineries. Pesticides are not being made. They're not being sprayed. Our military does not have the training to run farm tractors and so on. They would have to be trained. We're going to have interruptions in food supply, in seed supply, even if you wanted to grow those GMO seeds, even if you wanted to grow seeds that have Terminator in them, which, of course, we know isn't the case. But even if you wanted to, commercial agriculture will not be able to keep up with the needs for all the peoples of the world to eat. They will have bitten off more than they could chew because they will have spread these seeds, spread the commercial seeds all around the world to the point where everybody's dependent upon them, which is what is happening today. And if you have an interruption only one spring, only one summer, or only one fall, you have interrupted the global food supply. And I would argue that there are people who have gardens down in South America who are in better shape than we are in their ability to feed themselves. So when you go to the Ark Institute's website, by all means, pay attention to the writings under the food supply updates, explanations of all of the threats to your own ability to feed yourself, and then consider preparing for not only this summer, but by preparing for next year as well, because the day may come when you will be so grateful to be able to stay home and avoid the street. Avoid being told to get back in your house because of enforced quarantine. But anyway, again, it's ARK Institute, ARKInstitute.com, and 1-800-255-1912.
But now you have a lot of information up there about growing food and how to grow food, and then
absolutely.
And then you have a lot of information there about the recommendations that have been made by people who already studied the possibility of a pandemic, how to prepare for it, don't you?
That's right. As a matter of fact, you can download free off our website a big at-home manual for taking care of victims in your own family with pandemic influenza, a 34-page manual. I ask you, if you are financially able to do it, download it yourself, print one copy out on your printer. I know it takes a lot of toner, but go ahead and do it. And as much as you can afford, go ahead and print out other copies and give those copies to your neighbors who are not as able to afford it or don't have computers. This pamphlet can actually save lives. It was written by Dr. Gretton Woodson, that one particular pamphlet. There are others up there on the website for preparation. There are links to the government's own checklist for the things that you need to have in your home with your family. Your government is going to be very nervous about communicating the risk of pandemic to you because they want to give you this feeling that everything is as rosy as possible under the current leaders. I mean, that is the bottom line. Re-election's the bottom line. You have to understand. This all comes down to biological survival. This happens all the time. We are no different than any other race of people, any other generation of people who have lived upon this planet. Even with our advanced medicine, this is essentially 1918 medically, because we don't have anything right now that can cure this. We don't have enough hospital beds. We don't have enough ventilators, 105,000 ventilators in the entire U.S. That is nothing. It's a drop in the bucket for the next pandemic. So it really behooves people to do things. You'll find information on water filters, for example. You'll find information on non-hybrid seeds, the ones that you can support yourself on. You will find a large book called Country Wisdom and Know-How. That is the biggest wealth of information on how to take care of yourself and your family in terms of 4,000 some odd skills. How to plant everything, how to purify water, how to bake, how to make a solar oven. All of these things are in this one book, and it's under $20. I can't believe it myself. It weighs about 2 pounds. I have a couple of them in the office here. I refer to them all the time and refer people to it all the time because it's an inexpensive collection of a massive amount of information.
Now, what's the title of the book?
Yes, it's Country Wisdom and Know-How.
Country Wisdom and Know-How.
Know-how, yes. Huge. If I were people who were not prepared at all, I would order at least 20 packets of these non-hybrid seeds that you can store for years in your refrigerator. I would order at least those. I would order Country Wisdom and Know-How. I'd order a doctor's book. Ask the girl who talks on the who answers the phone about a doctor's book, an emergency room doctor's book on how to treat your own family at home. Names the medicines that you should ask your doctor for prescriptions for now to take care of secondary infections, for example, from influenza and so on. This could be a serious situation. We can get very fortunate. We can be very blessed. And the thing will move back into birds again and away from the mammalian host that it's in right now. It's in, for example, minks. It goes into dogs. It goes into cats. It goes into pigs. It's moving into mammals. Oh, cats are. They're thinking maybe cats have something to do with spreading it in these countries that have infected and dying cats. It kills 100% of cats. Maybe it's because the cats ate the birds. We don't know the answers to those questions. So maybe we'll get fortunate, Stan. Maybe it'll move back into lower animals again, out of mammals. But it's not looking that way now. Right now, it's worsening, and that's why the scientists in all countries, not people with certain agendas and certain wishes for the human race. Unfortunately, though, if this thing evolves, it will be a simple matter of spreading it around.
Okay, well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Jerry, and of course, I think it's a good idea for everybody in the listening audience to begin making the basic preparations that you would need in case something major were to happen, and whether it be the bird flu, whether it would be the coming war with Iran. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there seems to be very little question that there is going to be a war with Iran. I'm just back from Washington, D.C. last week and talked to at least one of the major architects of our foreign policy and a founding member of PNAC, one of the 27 original members of the Project for the American Century, who said unequivocally, in his opinion, that with the current administration's control over our government beginning to unravel a popularity rating at 31% or lower, that they are going to have to do something, and a very convenient way of rallying the people behind government is war. And so it is his opinion that they're going to precipitate a war. That was his statement. They are going to precipitate it, talking about a war with Iran. So whatever it would be, whether it be an influenza, whether it be the effects of war or terrorism, and I will tell you the worst thing we could possibly do at this stage would be to attack another country that was not a threat to us. We are, by making preemptive attacks, we are establishing a principle of international law that one day could be used against America. So, anyway, Jerry, certainly, what are some of the other things that you'd like to talk about?
Well, yes, going to Iran. As a matter of fact, I believe I read this week that the Iranian president had said that if the U.S. does attack preemptively, he will be attacking U.S. cities one at a time. The terrorists would do that. That threat is out there. It's very real. And yet it does look like we are planning to do that. That's what it looks like in stories that you read everywhere, and some of it in the mainstream press even, that it's looking like we're going to end up attacking Iran. We have given it so many warnings, and Iran basically is thumbing its nose at us every single day. Now, the fact that potassium iodate, which is one of those supplements that can be taken in the event of a nuclear cloud, the fact that it has been bought up in great quantities by our own government in the past several months is a further warning. The Ark Institute often gets requests for potassium iodate. So we have recently obtained two full cases of it. We had to wait, like others, for those cases to be fulfilled because the U.S. government is buying from the same single source here in the United States. So I would also suggest that people, if they are concerned about Iran's threat, that if we attack Iran unprovoked, that they will indeed attack U.S. cities. Most folks in military believe that there are parts of nuclear weapons or suitcase bombs here in the United States that are already in place that could be blown up, even if just to contaminate areas, if not to do major human damage, but to contaminate. They are going to then produce nuclear clouds, nuclear material that could be prevented from contaminating the human thyroid, which would be a sure future cancer, thyroid cancer. So that's what potassium iodate is used for. Government has been buying up in massive quantities, actually cutting off and making private supplies very limited. I'm happy to say that we have been fortunate to obtain just two cases of it, 200 bottles. We suggest one bottle for each adult in the family or a child over 12. But this is the same stuff that the U.S. government is ordering. And it is another reminder, thanks for jogging my memory on the Iran situation. Going back for a second to the president's speech tonight, the federal plan that I had quoted you a few paragraphs, it's called the National Strategy for Pandemic Influenza. On the borders, there's a nice little paragraph here. Federal quarantine and other movement restrictions, borders. The president, this is the scary part, because we know this president is quite... seems desperate to get his ratings up. The president has the authority to bar entry into the United States of aliens who have pandemic influenza if he determines that entry is detrimental to the interests of the United States. So that would say, of course, Dan, that he's had the ability to bar entry into the United States of aliens, period, you know, for any reason. The Secretary of Health and Human Services may prohibit the entry of persons or property from foreign countries where the entry of such persons or property would present a serious danger of the introduction of a communicable disease. That's a lot of imported goods there. The Homeland Security Department, Department of Homeland Security, has broad general authority pursuant to customs and immigration laws to examine merchandise, cargo, conveyances, and persons upon their entry to the United States and ensure that imports comply with U.S. law, and to seize and forfeit vessels, animals, other things used in unlawful importation and transportation, and so on. Furthermore, customs and Coast Guard officers and military officers commanding in any fort or station upon the seacoast are required to aid in the enforcement of state quarantines. So there is your border control in the event of a pandemic. Things are being put into place. The plans are made. I would refer folks to this document again at pandemicflu.gov.
And do you have a link to that on your website, Jay?
Yes, there is a link to that on the ARC Institute's website. And again, that is arkinstitute.com. You can link to these documents. Another thing I'd suggest you do is print out the family checklists and start going down them, putting in your medical information and so on. That's there for purpose. I'm going to guess that the purpose is that if there are door-to-door medical agents who are going to come to your home in the event that we have a somewhat controlled pandemic and they're going to be looking at individuals who are infected or people who are sick from other things, they're going to ask to see the list of drugs that your family member is on. What the medical history is. Also on there is next of kin statements. That's for obvious reasons. The other thing they're talking about in this document, there were a lot of people saying that the movie was an exaggeration. No, if we have large deaths, we're going to be looking at mass graves, and if you read these documents, you'll see the U.S. government is doing that right now, looking at what to do with all of the bodies that will occur if indeed pandemic influenza carries a high fatality ratio.
Well, of course, we don't know whether it will or not, but if it did, why, you'd certainly have to be considering all things. We'll be back here in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti and of the ARC Institute. And, of course, Jerry does support Radio Liberty, and we love having her on here as a regular guest. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Jerry, go ahead. You got 3 minutes to wrap up the program here.
All righty. I would really suggest that folks keep in touch with the news. Go to the ARC Institute's website. You're going to find links to other websites as well that are going to help you to prepare. I would also, if that link isn't up there anymore, I think it is, but if not, I'd also recommend that you go to an outstanding website that can give you daily updates on influenza and other human health issues, emerging diseases, and that's CIDRAP, CIDRAP.UMN, that's University of Minnesota, UMN.EDU, so that's CIDRAP.UMN.EDU. I believe you'll find it on the ARC Institute's website, but if not, I would bring it to you tonight and tell you go there. That's Dr. Osterholm's group, the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, and its outstanding top flight, blue ribbon site. Go there to keep up on what's going on in Indonesia. And please, by all means, go to arcinstitute.com or call 1-800-255-1912. Get a hold of a book to help you put together those self-sufficiency skills that will help you and your family during this time. Again, it's a sure thing we'll have a pandemic. The world doesn't end before it. It's a sure thing we'll have a pandemic in our lifetimes. It's just a matter of when that pandemic is going to occur. This one's looking pretty good. This one's looking like the one that might be the first one of the 21st century. It may not. It may evolve backwards into birds again, but right now it's looking pretty bad. It's evolved into mammals, an increasing number of mammals, and it's in humans, and it's now going, at least in family situations, person to person with close contact. Indonesia may be the big red flag for the first more easily transmitted version. We're looking for the mutations now. If they've occurred, we have ourselves a problem, a big problem. Prepared.
Okay, fine. Of course, it could be all from the pig, couldn't it? In other words, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going person to person if they all ate the same
thing. It could all be from the pig, and the pig may be the common thing, and because it can go into the gut, it's possible that the pig was undercooked or that handling the pig did it, although all 8 family members wouldn't be doing it. One of the people who died today was a 4-year-old child.
Well, we're going to have to wait and see. Anyway, Jerry Guidetti, we're out of time, but thanks very much, and we'll look forward to having you with us again next week or the week after that.
My pleasure, Stan.
Good night. God bless you. Okay, fine. Well, our guest has been Jerry Guidetti from the ARC Institute. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do really hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If you'd like to understand the immigration problem, we have a great 4-tape set on immigration, and you have to understand they could have solved the problem at any time simply by enforcing the laws against hiring illegal aliens. They do not want to solve the problem. They want the problem so they can justify bringing in the 20 million people who are already here illegally, so they can bring in their families, so they can change the entire structure of our society, play one group against the other, and of course turn Mexican against white and white against Mexican. A multicultural, multilingual society is one that you can very easily manipulate, and there really are people who like to do that, because you divide, you conquer, you control. There are people who have a different vision. Somebody has referred to them as Olympians. That's a term that Judge Bork has used. The Olympians are the ruling elite who create problems, and then, of course, there's always a new series of laws on hand to solve the problems that they've created. understand the techniques, you need to get our book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, available by calling 1-800-544-8927. You can get that with a DVD and or video, or you can get the original audio tape of the original talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you have not yet read our other materials available at Radio Liberty. Certainly, we write a monthly newsletter. If you'd like to get a free copy of that newsletter, give us a call. And then you really need to see my talk. It's called The World Revolution. You see, the World Revolution really began back in 1776. The American Revolution was a series of revolutions that all had a common origin. They came from secret societies, they came from the occult, and the documentation for that, of course, comes from James H. Billington's book, Fire in the Minds of Men. Now, it's very interesting, James H. Billington's the Librarian of Congress, he tries to play down the influence of the secret societies in America. In fact, we had a terrible time getting from the Library of Congress the information that they were concealing on the Clintonian Illuminati. Was a treatise written in 1803. Unfortunately, Dr. Keddie and I were able to liberate that from the Library of Congress at some expense and some trouble, but we have that, we offer it to you, and then, of course, you'll certainly want to read our latest newsletter, which goes into the story of the angel that rides in the whirlwind and directs the storm. That will be our April newsletter, which will be available very, very shortly and will be posted on our website, hopefully before very long. You'll certainly want to get my February and March newsletters, which deal with the embedded message in President Bush's second inaugural address, which explains the mysterious emblem on the back of the dollar bill. Did you ever wonder what an occult satanic emblem is doing on the back of the dollar bill? People will tell you that's this symbol of masonry, but of course it has been around long before masonry was ever there. It's a symbol of the ancient mystery religions. We're in real trouble, ladies and gentlemen. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, because if this country doesn't turn back to God, we're going to lose this nation. And then, of course, pray for our leaders and ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Arthur Bernclough from Veterans for Constitutional Law. Of course, Arthur is himself a veteran, but he helps veterans to navigate the rather crass and indifferent programs that are put forward by the Veterans Administration for taking care of veterans with service-connected disabilities, and we have some real problems. We send our men overseas to fight for freedom, as we often lose our freedom here at home. And many times when these young men come back from overseas, whether it be the Second World War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the First Gulf War, the so-called Desert Storm, and even now with Iran, these people are having very difficult times many times with the Veterans Administration getting the care that they've been promised and the benefits that they've been promised. So with that as a background, Arthur, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
Good evening, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to do a program with you.
Well, tell us what some of the things that you're working on at the present time.
Okay. We've got some more facts about Mr. Principi, the departed head of the Veterans Administration. Mr. Nicholson has taken his place, and Mr. Principi left the Veterans Administration under some very shady circumstances. And it turns out now, the real reason Mr. Principi's departure was never really given. However, a special report that was published by eminent scientist Lauren Murray, naming depleted uranium as the definitive cause of the Gulf War syndrome, it's fed a growing scandal about the continued use of uranium munitions by the United States military. And this malady from uranium munitions that thousands of our military has suffered and died from, it's finally been identified as the major cause of this sickness. Not the only cause, but the major cause. Eliminating the guessing, and the terrible truth was revealed finally when this report was put out. And basically, it's out of the 580,400 soldiers who served in Gulf War I, the first Gulf War, of them, 11,000 are now dead. By the year 2000, there were 325,000 on permanent medical disability, and this astounding number of disabled vets means that a decade later, 56% of those soldiers who served have some form of permanent medical problems, and the disability rates for the wars of the last century was 5%. And in Vietnam, it was higher. It was 10%. But this is 56% now. Now, the VA Secretary Principi was totally aware of this fact as far back as the year 2000. He and the Bush administration have been hiding these facts, but now, thanks to Murray's report, it became too big to hide or cover up.
I see, and so, well, now I hadn't really heard of it, so basically, where did she get her figures that, you know, there was over 325,000? Were those official government figures?
Directly from the VA.
All right, fine. We'll be back here in just a moment with Arthur Bernclough and talking about the tragic situation that exists as far as our servicemen coming home. You know, about a third, at least 30% of our servicemen coming home from Iraq today, within 3 months, have an illness of some sort. They call it psychological. I don't really think it is. Go ahead, Arthur. You were just saying that this figure, 325,000, we know an awful lot of these young people really are tragically incapacitated, and many of them have serious disabilities.
Oh, yeah.
And Arthur was saying that the figures that Dr. Lorraine Murray has put out,
right.
She has a PhD and is an accredited scientist. She feels it's about 30% of them, pardon me, about 325,000, have some sort of a permanent disability from the VA. Pick up the story there, Arthur.
Okay, the figures were given by the Veterans Administration. Terry Jameson, the Public Affairs Specialist of the Office of Deputy Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the VA Central Office, recently reported that Gulf-era veterans now on medical disability since 1991 number, right now, 518,739 veterans. And these figures.
Wait a minute now. You're speaking now. This is total veterans. You're not speaking just of the second Gulf War.
No.
First Gulf War.
With this amount, it's now total.
All right. That's the total that would be then Second World War, Vietnam, Korea,
yeah.
and the Gulf War?
This is the amount, 518,739, Gulf War I and some of Gulf War II. Of Gulf War I, 325,000 by the year 2000 were impaired, and they were on permanent medical disability, and the figure has now grown. The figure now, between that, at that time, and people who were starting to fight in Gulf War II, now numbers 518,739. And these figures were confirmed by the Department of Defense as well.
Now, have you actually checked that yourself, or is that
sure? I have.
You have. All right, fine. I certainly would want to get that number, and I'd like to see if we can get that in writing from him. But let's go right ahead, Arthur.
Okay. The long-term effects have revealed that DU—that's uranium oxide—it's a virtual death sentence. And Marion Folk, who's a nuclear physical chemist, retired from the Lawrence Livermore nuclear weapons lab. She was also with the Manhattan Project, interprets the new and rapid malignancies in these soldiers from the 2003 Iraq War is spectacular and a matter of concern. When asked the main purpose of using DU was for destroying things and killing people, Folk was more specific. She replied, "I would say it is the perfect weapon for killing lots of people. In the interim, Mr. Principi could not be reached, because he got a new job, and his new job with the government is closing military bases." And this is just as a starter with Mr. Principi.
Hold that thought right there, please, Arthur. And certainly, Arthur Bernkoros, talking about the large number of our veterans who already are on disability now. And we do know, and we have at least this from solid sources, that approximately of those veterans who come back without being injured or maimed, about 30% of those within 3 months are having serious problems. They want to call it post-traumatic stress, but of course that's a very, very broad term. That's what they use for the Gulf War after the first Gulf War. So the question is, why are so many of the veterans returning having problems? Some of them probably are post-traumatic stress or psychological, but some of them can be from other physical ailments too. And certainly there's a very real concern about depleted uranium, because the depleted uranium, you can pick up and handle it, but once it is fired, it turns into a very fine dust, and that can be inhaled. And of course, once it's inhaled, it gets into the alveoli of your lungs, picked up by the blood, and then of course disseminated throughout the body to those areas where, of course, depleted uranium would be deposited, specifically into the area of bone marrow. And of course, this is why some of these people would have a tendency towards an increase of leukemia and lymphomas. But go ahead, Arthur.
You see the basic difference in Gulf War I and Gulf War II. In Gulf War I, we had the aspect of a chemical warfare going on. A lot of the people got sick from something called Mycoplasma incognitus fermentis. Now, in Gulf War II, that ceased to be. The chemical aspect disappeared from this, and it was purely the depleted uranium and the radiation poisoning that it's caused here. Now, we're not talking about PTSD or anything else. We'll get into that later. I want to keep things focused. if we can. Basically, Mr. Principe was talked into forced retirement and took another government job, and he got a predator's job like he always gets, just closing military bases. But now things are starting to be revealed about Mr. Principe. Now, former Veterans Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Mr. Principe, he simply earned a tan and lots of future income while serving, I think, in a traitorous capacity as VA Secretary. But more so, just like his cousins in the lobbyist mafia, he aligned himself to make tremendous future income by screwing our veterans. And I'll tell you how he did this. Veterans Administration contracts went to Principe's own company. Anthony Principe has held key positions at the Diamond Bar Medical Firm, QTC, before and after heading the VA. And the fees that he has been paid could exceed $1 billion.
Well, now, where is this recorded?
The Los Angeles Times. Walter F. Roche, Jr.
And this is a reporter, then, who actually investigated this.
Yep, April 23rd. They did a whole investigation on this.
And they actually said that the fees has been paid. It could be that.
It could exceed $1 billion.
And what were these fees paid for to these private concern, or to this private concern? Why was the Veterans Administration paying sums to that?
I'm getting into that right now.
Okay, great.
They're being paid for medical evaluations, physical and medical evaluations of veterans and of returning people from the wars. Now, Mr. Principe has held these key positions at the Diamond Bar Medical Firm, and Mr. Principe could get fees exceeding $1 billion. They're estimating it'll probably come to about $1.2 billion from the VA. Much of it on contracts which were approved and amended while he ran the agency.
In other words, he doesn't get that. That goes to this corporation that he's works for, has worked for.
It goes to the corporation, and he's a principal in that corporation.
Right, fine. And, because it sounds very much like Dick Cheney and Halliburton.
Oh, yeah.
And Halliburton gets all of these no-bid contracts from the government. And, of course, the vice president has a great deal of stock, and he has continued, at least he did for many years, as the vice president, getting what was called deferred salary. I don't quite understand. I can get a salary from a private corporation when you're the vice president of the United States, but I guess us common people aren't smart enough to understand that sort of thing, the way that high finance works. But Halliburton has been getting all of these no-bid contracts, and time and time and time again, they've been investigated to find out that they were actually cheating the government, and then, of course, they would pay them anyway. Of course, I wouldn't want to suggest there was any relationship between Dick Cheney and Halliburton just because he's getting a deferred salary for them, and it sounds like this is really what's happening with Mr. Princetti. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, but it's even worse. believe it or not, it's even worse here. If you let me get into this, I'm going to tell you exactly what happened. I've got a very good couple of articles here.
All right, fine. I certainly hope you'll fax those to me, Walter. Pardon me,
yeah,
Arthur.
Everything has been researched.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Now, he ran the VA for 4 years, and then he returned to the firm afterward as chairman of the board. In other words, after he left the VA, they made him chairman of the board, and he still took the job of closing bases. Now, while he was VA secretary, his past and future corporate home collected about $246 million in fees, according to VA records. Congressional Budget Office projections show the contracts could be worth as much as $1.2 billion through 2008. Principe said he had no role in awarding, amending, or administering VA contracts with QTC. He's claiming, while at the VA, I had no contact with QTC on any business matter and recused myself entirely from any issues or business that QTC might have had with the VA. He said he compiled this with federal statutes barring contact with the VA after his departure. And He cited his two sons' recent combat service, Principi, caring for these young men and women. We sent to war is the only thing that motivates me, whether I'm in public office or any aspect of business where their interests are at stake. What a phony, excuse me for saying this, anyway. Whether or to what extent Principi stands to benefit from QTC's success was not determined immediately. He said he held non-vested stock options in QTC, but he did not say how many shares. Now, Principi's firm administers medical exams to veterans seeking disability assistance. It also examines soldiers before they're discharged, and the results of the exams play a substantial role in the VA disability benefit decisions. Though the VA is QTC's biggest customer, the company does similar exams for other agencies and private insurance, but not to the extent that they do it for the VA. Now, according to its website, QTC owns and operates 31 medical evaluation facilities and has produced more than 2.5 million medical exams and reports. And Principi, who was deputy VA secretary and acting secretary under George H.W. Bush, the father, and also served as Republican chief counsel and staff director of the Senate Armed Forces Committee a decade ago. Now, in 1996, he was named chairman of a congressional task force on veterans issues. His panel recommended having a standardized comprehensive physical exam for outgoing military personnel. That recommendation led to exams conducted by QTC. The firm began its relationship with the VA in 1998, conducting disability exams under a pilot program. Principi joined the company in 1999. QTC's initial performance drew some criticism. As mandated by Congress, its work was reviewed by a private consulting firm, which said QTC's fees were much higher than expected. Now, get these fees, Dr. Stan. A QTC hearing exam, for instance, averaged $495.55, compared with $89.80 for an in-house VA exam. Even with an adjustment for possible hidden costs, the difference exceeded 400%. For a general medical exam, QTC's average fee outside was $393.52, compared with the VA's $225.58. The consultants found they recommended further cost comparison studies, but such an analysis was never done. Now, VA officials, in a written response to Time's question, said a follow-up study was not done, and get this reason, because the QTC fee schedule was studied carefully by the technical evaluation teams and found to be reasonable and fair. $89.80 as compared to $495.55. Does that sound reasonable and fair to you, Dr. Stan? It doesn't to me. Anyway, in the program's third year, Mr. Principi was nominated to be VA secretary. He told the Senate panel considering his confirmation that he had terminated all relationships with QTC and waived any and all future rights or benefits that could flow from his relationship with that organization.
What did he keep his stock in that and his stock options?
Yes. Absolutely, and still, Principi's 2001 financial disclosure, that's the year he joined the VA, listed a $250,000 bonus he received from QTC. He was careful to do it right before his confirmation, January 23rd, but he received that bonus right before his confirmation, January 23rd.
A lot of these people give immorality a bad name, and we've seen this. Senator Frist, who is a majority leader of the United States Senate, who has a blind trust, which he personally directs. How can you have a blind trust when you're personally directing it? And he ordered the sale of a number of shares of his own stock, knowing the price was going to go down. This is the sort of thing that goes on all the time in government. And every once in a while, they'll get somebody like Duke Cunningham and send him off to the pokey for, misusing funds. you have to have morality. But then, once you've rejected God, why should anybody be moral if you can get away with it?
Oh, man, I'd love to get a license plate made by Duke Cunningham for my memorability collection.
Okay, go right ahead there. But you can't talk to any music, Arthur. Because
I'm sorry. What I was saying is I'd love to get a license plate made by Duke Cunningham someday for my memorability collection.
Right, well, of course, he only got a couple of $1 million, you know, and he was a piker compared with a lot of these other people. But go right ahead.
Okay, now, QTC's initial performance drew this criticism, but as I said before, the work was reviewed, and they said QTC's fees were okay, they were in line. But as I said before, compare $495.55 as compared to $89.80 for an in-house examination. And now they are believing that QTC had an agenda, too, to deny these claims. And in most cases with the VA, the doctors there signed off, and the people did not even have a doctor, an MD's evaluation, on their physical evaluations. They were done by the clerks at QTC. The doctors at the VA hospital simply signed off to the clerks in QTC. So it's hanky panky in more ways than one. I mean, it's absolutely it's an absolute sleazy setup that they had there at the VA, and they still have it.
And of course, basically, once of course the exam says there's nothing wrong with the person, then they get no longer become eligible for disability. Is that right?
Exactly. Now, here's something here. As the number of sites multiplied, so did QTC's revenue. It went from $8 million in fees in 1998 to $69.1 million in 2005. And Principi wrote in response to questions he had nothing to do with the expansion of sites while he was a secretary. I say, tell me another one, Tony. And QTC has got some additional critics. North Carolina attorney Hugh Cox, who frequently represents veterans, accuses the company of working with the VA to deny disability claims. This is where we found out about the doctors signing off to the clerks in QTC, and the clerks wrote the medical evaluation. And one of Cox's clients, Vietnam veteran Jimmy S. Pollock, was told to appear for a physical exam scheduled, believe it or not, 2 days before he received the notice. They put me down as a no-show, he said. According to VA data, QTC has been paid $6.2 million since May 2003 for no-show exams. VA officials say QTC's no-show rate is 10.86, which is considered excellent. Seattle psychiatrist Philip B. Plattner, who's worked at veterans' health facilities for 23 years, was one of the first to question QTC's expanded role. He launched a letter-writing campaign warning that veterans could be the victims of inadequate evaluations. And they were. The MDs were not doing the evaluations. They were signing off, and the clerks at QTC were doing them. And Plattner said the VA was paying double what it should. That's what he said at that time. But it wasn't double. It was 4 to 5 times as much. And he cited data from a May 2005, they did one Inspector General's report, May 2005. It showed the average cost of a QTC exam was even higher, what I mentioned before. It was $500.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Arthur Bernkopf from Veterans for Constitutional Law. And we're talking about, of course, this organization, QTC, that is getting $400 to $500 for these exams being done on veterans. But apparently, according to Arthur, the doctors are not doing the exams. They're done by clerks. And then a doctor scans the report and signs it. And it sounds like, of course, it's simply a means of funneling money to a private corporation that is doing examinations and coming up with conclusions that there's nothing wrong with the veterans, and that way they can withhold paying them the disability payments. And that is the function of the VA, is not to provide payments for veterans who are really entitled to it, but how can you justify withholding that? And if, when you're having a private corporation do the exam, is it exorbitant fees? Are you surprised that they come up and they don't find anything at all? Pick up the story there, Arthur.
Okay, now the value of QTC's federal contracts became apparent late last year when the firm was sold to Spectrum, a Massachusetts-based venture capital firm, for a reported $270 million. That's talking big money here. A partner who spearheaded the Spectrum purchase was Stephen Price, a colleague of Principi's in the George W. Bush administration, who served as a deputy defense secretary. Price was named to the QTC board immediately after the purchase, but since has stepped down. And Principi acknowledged discussing with Price his return to QTC before the sale. Spectrum approached me about joining the company if they were successful in purchasing QTC, Principi wrote. Spectrum and QTC have refused to disclose whether QTC's VA contract was pledged as security for the $150 million loan used to finance the purchase. And an investment firm's report on the sale noted QTC's very close relationship with the VA and said QTC has integrated its process and systems with the VA and has even co-located several offices at VA facilities.
Well, it certainly sounds like there's a very much of an incestuous relationship. And, of course, the true tragedy is you're saying simply the government is being used as a piggy bank for the use of private people. We have certainly more corruption today with the Republicans in office, and I'm a lifelong Republican, but we have more corruption today than we ever had under the Democrats. We've had the greatest increase in debt we've ever seen. We've seen more expansion of government control. We've seen more socialist programs brought in with the Bush administration. Ted Kennedy's programs, which Senator Kennedy couldn't get through, have been passed by the Bush administration. Maybe that's why in 2003 the Bush Foundation gave to the politician, the most outstanding politician in the country, they gave their reward for the Bush Foundation to none other than that great American patriot, Ted Kennedy. Maybe there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, but they can't let the American people know that. Go ahead, Arthur.
I think you're right. I don't think there is a bit of difference between them. Now, you're familiar with Mr. Bush is doing now in Iraq with the new embassy.
Yes, we certainly heard this is to be the largest embassy anywhere in the world, which he is going to put in there. Keeps telling us he's going to pull our troops out. Why would you build the largest embassy in the world in Iraq if you're really planning on pulling our troops out? Why would you be building 14 new military bases over there if you're really going to pull our troops out?
He appropriated $592 million for this place, which is going to sit on 104 acres. And by the way, they have already gone over the 592. They're looking to appropriate more money for this. And it's a heavily guarded 104-acre site with a 15-foot-thick perimeter wall, and hundreds of workers are working on a scaffolding right now. And local residents are bitter that the Kuwaiti contractor employs only foreign staff and is busing them in from a temporary camp nearby Iraq. And after roughing it in Saddam's abandoned palaces, diplomats should have every comfort in their new home. There's going to be impressive residences for the ambassador and his deputy, 6 apartments for senior officials, and 2 huge office blocks for 8,000 staff to work in. And there's going to be what's rumored to be the biggest swimming pool in Iraq, a state-of-the-art gymnasium, a cinema, restaurants offering delicacies from the United States' favorite food places, tennis courts, and a Swish American Club for evening functions.
Evening entertainment. We'll be back in just a moment with Arthur Burnclow here at Radio Liberty, and of course, we'll invite your calls. Hold your calls for the time being. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Arthur Bernclough from Veterans for Constitutional Law, just talking about all these government boondoggles we're seeing, and of course he's been talking about the Veterans Administration, and then carried over to the building of this magnificent palatial new embassy in Iraq. We're told, oh, we're only going to be there shortly. Why do you need a $500 million embassy if thus we're planning on having our troops stationed there permanently? And I would like to suggest that is exactly what we're planning on doing. And anybody who's read the material for the project to the New American Century, you'll find it on their website, newamericancentury.org, will realize that we plan to station our troops permanently in the Middle East long before the 9/11 attack. It was just so convenient that that attack came along, because that way we could mobilize the American people and get them to be willing to go to war, first with Afghanistan and then with Iraq and then coming with Iran. But what's this really all about? Well, let's get back to Arthur. Go ahead, Arthur.
It's going to happen, the war with Iran. It's just a question of when. Now, this is not just an embassy. This is a complex of 21 buildings that are being put up in the same complex. They're putting 21 buildings up there, and the $592 billion, they're already out of money, and they have to appropriate more money to finish this up. And I'd like to talk now about the Veterans Benefits Commission. The Vets Commission Chair, Terry Scott. Now, this is a push to cut veterans who are getting SSI and VA compensation. And every year or two, you're always finding some guy in government who says, let's cut veterans who are getting Social Security and veterans benefits. They shouldn't be getting both. And this happens every few years or so. And the latest is General Terry Scott, who I friended with in Alabama, and Terry Scott has had battles with almost every veterans advocate in the country. I ran across him in Alabama. And the government put him up, well, actually not the government, Mr. Bush himself, put General Terry Scott up to run the Veterans Disability Commission. Now, they made it up of 13 people who are on the commission, and they asked me if I wanted to be on this, and I said, no way. I saw a list of the other people who were picked. I said, there isn't a way in the world I can work with these people. So 9 of the 13 were appointed, 5 directly by Mr. Bush.
Now, hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment with Arthur Bernclough. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Arthur Bernclough, Veterans for Constitutional Law. Arthur, why don't we get your website, why don't we get your telephone number out so people know how to get in touch with you if they'd like more information on the Veterans Administration disability payments, or people having trouble navigating through this this morass, which is designed not to provide for the veterans, but to prevent them from getting what they've been promised. So go ahead, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, that's what we're here for, to help veterans with their benefits. I'm Arthur Bernclough. I'm Executive Director, and it's Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited. Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited. And we are located at 112 Jefferson Avenue in Port Jefferson, New York. Port Jefferson, New York. Our zip code is 11777. 11777, and I'm quite accessible by telephone. Number is 631-474-4261, and if you contact us, we will get back to you in a very, very short time. You can contact us by mail or contact us by telephone. For a while, I was telling people to contact our email thing, but I don't want my computers crashing again. We get too many responses on that now.
All right, fine. So go ahead. And then, of course, you were just simply talking about this general who seems to be an appointed, to have a committee, and their major thrust is to try to take veterans who are receiving SSI and take away then their veterans' benefits, saying, well, you know, just because you worked all your life and, you know, you're entitled to SSI, Social Security, or Social Security retirement, then, of course, you can't continue getting your veterans' benefit, which you've been getting for many years, because of your disability for the to service. So pick up the story there, Arthur.
Okay, this is a push to cut benefits for veterans who get VA and Social Security compensation. And every couple of years or so, somebody comes up with this idea to harass veterans getting them and try and remove their benefits. The Vets Commission chair, the chairman is General Terry Scott, and he wants the study if vets should get VA compensation and Social Security disability at the same time with the aim of reducing benefits. In an unconstitutional move, he is asking Congress to interpret its own law so that he would have the power to launch a study. Now, Congress, by law, is not allowed to interpret its own law. That should be done by the courts only. Now, the next step in dismantling veterans' benefits could be a payment reduction known as an offset for veterans receiving disability compensation and Social Security. And most of these veterans have paid into Social Security all of their lives anyway. And the veteran's disability is a completely different thing from the Social Security. Now, the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission, called the VDBC, was established by Public Law 108-136, and it was signed into being by President Bush in November 2003. And the charter states they are to study whether a veteran's disability or death should be compensated, and at what level, if any. Since this commission was first established, it was obvious to veterans and veteran service organizations that the commission had one thing in mind, and that was to cut veterans' benefits. Now, the VDBC is made up of 13 political appointees. Four were appointed by the Democratic members of Congress, four more by Republican members, and the other five by President Bush. Now, the Democrats have appointed Rick Surratt of the Disabled American Veterans Organization, who is about as anti-veteran as you can get, and also Mr. Butch Jockel, who was let go by the DAV. They threw him out of their organization for using DAV funds, to pay for private lawyers to defend him in a sexual harassment suit by one of the female members of the DAV. And they asked me if I want to join. I said I can't work with these people. Now the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission, it's truly a 9-to-4 politically stacked deck, even though they like to refer to themselves as bipartisan. And the legality of the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission has been questioned by many veterans advocates. And as their meetings progressed, veterans began to notice a secretive quality to the workings of the commission. Last fall, the VDBC issued a list of questions that they would study, and they asked for input and gave veterans just a few days over a holiday weekend to respond. The questions signaled the direction of the VDBC, and one question that was asked for them to answer is, does the disability benefit provided affect a veteran's incentive to work? And now, secretive has taken on a new meaning. In a recent editorial written by Arthur H. Wilson, who's the national adjutant for the Disabled American Veterans Organization, we find optimism was in short supply at the commission's March 16th, 17th meeting, as some of its members maneuvered to authorize collecting data about Social Security Disability Insurance, that's SSDI benefits, paid to veterans who also receive VA disability compensation. And that was done with a view toward an offset reduction of disability insurance if the veteran receives disability compensation from the VA. That's regardless of whether the disability he's getting from the VA and the disability he's getting from Social Security is the same thing. In most cases, it's not. Now, Wilson continues, a move to sidestep proper procedures and hold a secret ballot on the matter was postponed, but the issue is expected to resurface at the commission's meeting on May 19th, that's this Friday. If so, it could lay the groundwork for cutting or eliminating veterans' benefits as a way of saving the government money. The idea that disability compensation is some kind of an income security or welfare program cheapens the service and sacrifice of disabled veterans. And that kind of thinking might also open the door to cutting off VA compensation when a disabled veteran becomes eligible to collect Social Security retirement benefits. Veterans' benefits are separate and distinct from Social Security, so receiving payments under both programs is not dual compensation for the same disability, as some have tried to argue. Now, they claim the VDBC is about evenly split on the idea of studying the SSDI issue, but the chairman, retired Army General, Lieutenant General Terry Scott, is adamant about getting this on the agenda and wants the power to move forward, and he wants the help of Congress to push his agenda. Now, Scott has taken the liberty of writing to Congress asking them to interpret their own law that established this commission. Now, this presents a problem. It is unconstitutional for Congress to interpret its own laws. Congress passes the laws, and the courts interpret them. But this hasn't stopped General Scott. In an email to the House and Senate Armed Services and the Veterans Affairs Committees, General Scott writes, "Some commissioners believe that this charge, the VDVC's charter, should be interpreted broadly to mean all related benefits received by disabled veterans under the laws of the United States to include SSDI payments. The chairman would appreciate clarification of the intent in Congress in writing or in person during the next commission public hearing, May 19th, 2006. He's asking Congress to break the law and interpret their own law. Now, General Scott's unconstitutional request has raised major concerns among all veterans advocates. Christopher Clay, general counsel for the DAV, has written to the four chairmen involved. In part, Clay's letter states, "General Scott's request, if honored, would violate one of the fundamental principles which have guided the government of the United States for more than 200 years. That principle is the separation of powers. Congress exercises the sole power to enact laws, while the judicial and executive branches have the power to say what those laws mean. Neither a committee of either the House or Senate, nor the full Congress, may interpret a statute after it is enacted without passing a new law. The DAV is unaware of any precedent for the congressional interpretations requested by the commission chairman. If the committee responds to the chairman's inquiry, it'll set a precedent that the courts are no longer the sole arbiters of disputes over our laws."
Well, I'll tell you what, Arthur, that seems a little hard to understand. I mean, if the legislature doesn't understand what the laws that they passed mean, then how could we possibly expect the courts to? I mean, if Congress doesn't know what they're doing, if they do not know the meaning of the law, and the idea that once you pass the law, then the courts can change them and say whatever it wants to, or the executive can, that's ridiculous. The Congress passes the laws, and then the executive is supposed to enact those laws or carry them out, and the judge's part would only be involved if there was something unconstitutional. The idea that Congress cannot interpret its own laws, if that is the law, then that is the most ridiculous thing. Well, then it is totally wrong.
Whether it's wrong or right, they're violating the Constitution by interpreting their own law.
Where,
it's unconstitutional.
How can it be unconstitutional? Where does it say that the Congress passes a law and it's unconstitutional for Congress to say
what that law is? It says so right in the Constitution.
Whereabouts?
I don't know the exact place, but it's right in the Constitution.
I've studied the Constitution. There's no statement that Congress can't interpret the law. They make the law, they should know what it means, and if they don't know what it means, they shouldn't be in Congress. But anyway, go ahead, Arthur.
That's the way the law is written. They write the laws, the courts interpret them. It's not interpreted after they write the law, the courts will interpret it. If they have to pass new laws, then they'll pass new laws. But the courts are the only ones who can interpret this law. Now, General Scott must be reminded that veterans' disability compensation is not welfare, and it's not to be confused with welfare or any other sort of compensation. Veterans receive disability compensation because they've earned it with their blood. Many earned it on the fields of battle, and they don't deserve to lose it in a commission hearing. Now, he has gotten two favorable responses from Congress. One is from Representative Steve Beyer, the head of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. And Steve Beyer, we know him. He's a Gulf veteran, but he's a Gulf veteran who hates other veterans. Everybody who's had business with him says the man is a psychopath, and I'm in agreement. I've talked to him a few times, and I think he is. I think he's a psychopath. And the other is the new Senate leader of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, Larry Craig of Idaho. Now, the reason he got picked for that job is there are less veterans in Idaho, so he doesn't have to worry about veterans demonstrating outside there. They picked this man because there are less veterans in his state. Actually, nobody wanted that job of Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. And the other two who have supported the idea of this witch hunt that they're going on is Representative Duncan Hunter, Republican of California, and Representative Ike Skelton, Democrat of Missouri. He's the ranking member of the same committee that Duncan Hunter is the chairman, Armed Forces. And it's our view that a comprehensive review under the laws of the United States would inescapably include an examination of the Social Security Disability Program, and the commission would be remiss in its responsibilities if it were to choose to ignore any form of federal compensation provided to such veterans. That's what these people write into the commission. And it looks like a done deal, but General Scott must get the entire 13 members to vote on this on the May 19th meeting. And they claim the panel is evenly divided on the issue, but I think it's going to overwhelmingly call for an investigation on this.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I think that there are people who would like to cut back on the veterans' compensation. But since you pay into your Social Security, you should be considered to be entitled to that. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has held that Social Security really is not an insurance policy. It is a welfare benefit. And so it'll be very interesting to see how can they make it a welfare benefit. Simply, the courts have said, doesn't matter that you paid into it. You thought it was an insurance policy. The money's already been spent. There is no money in the Social Security Fund. It is simply money, of course, that is being paid to you as a welfare benefit. And, of course, too bad you have been taken advantage of. But anyway, so I wouldn't be at all surprised if they did not cut the veterans' benefits, even though I think it's totally immoral to do it. They talk about, you know, when they send the boys off to fight and die and suffer and lose arms and legs in foreign battles, how much we appreciate our veterans. And then when you come home, why, it's an entirely different story.
Exactly. I have a very interesting letter here, which was sent to President Bush by a retired Navy helicopter pilot, naval officer by the name of Joseph W. DeRosa. And he addressed this to the President in the White House. Dear Mr. President, as a young man, I was honored to serve our nation as a commissioned officer and helicopter pilot in the United States Navy. Before me in World War II, my father defended the country, spending 2 years in the Pacific aboard the USS Hornet. We were patriots sworn to protect and defend. Today I conclude that you have dishonored our service and the Constitution and the principles of our oath. My dad was buried with full military honors, so I cannot act for him. But for myself, I return enclosed the symbols of my years of service, the shoulder boards of my rank, and my naval aviator's wings. Under your administration, I believed it was inconceivable that the United States would ever initiate an aggressive and preemptive war against a country that posed no threat to us. Until your administration, I thought it was impossible for our nation to take hundreds of persons into custody without provable charges of any kind, and to disappear them into holes like Gitmo, Abu Ghraib, and Bagram. Until your administration, in my wildest legal fantasy, I could not imagine a U.S. Attorney General seeking to justify torture, or a president first stating his intent to veto an anti-torture law, and then adding a signing statement that he intends to ignore such law as he sees fit. I do not want these things done in my name. As a citizen, a patriot, a parent, and a grandparent, as a lawyer and law teacher, I am left with such a feeling of loss and helplessness. I think of myself as a good American, and I ask myself, what can I do when I see the face of evil? Illegal and immoral war, torture, and confinement for life without trial have never been part of our constitutional tradition. But my vote has become meaningless because I live in a safe district drawn by your political party. My congressman is unresponsive to my concerns because his time is filled with lobbyist largesse. Protests are limited to your free speech zones out of sight of the parade. Even speaking openly is to risk being labeled un-American, pro-terrorist, or anti-troops, and I am a disciplined pacifist, so any violent act is out of the question. Nevertheless, to remain silent is to let you think I approve or support your actions. I do not, so I am saddened to give up my wings and bars. They were hard won, and my parents and wife were as proud as I was when I earned them over 40 years ago. But I hate the torture and death that you have caused more than I value their symbolism. Giving them up makes me cry for my beloved country. And that's by Joseph W. DeRosa.
Hold that thought. We'd be right back with Dr. Bernstein. Well, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and certainly Arthur was simply reading this letter that a retired officer had sent to the president, and I tend to agree with everything he said. The thing that really disturbs me more is that more people are not upset by the torture. More people are not upset by the fact that we were deceived as to why we went into the war. More people are not upset about this whole idea of a preemptive war, not only with Iraq, but now with Iran, and you go back and you even look at the justification for going into Afghanistan. If we went into Afghanistan to catch Osama bin Laden, why did we give up the effort to pursue him and then go ahead and attack Iraq? Or maybe we never really intended to get Osama bin Laden. And if you read my newsletters, you will find out time after time we could have gotten Osama bin Laden. We did not. All during the years between 1996 and 2001, when Osama bin Laden was staying in Afghanistan under the auspices of the Taliban, we were funding the Taliban. We were the largest source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan, which we were funding the Taliban government by providing humanitarian aid there. Why would we do that if we really were concerned about the wicked Osama bin Laden? So I would like to suggest that nothing as it appears to be. And Arthur, what really disturbs me is that
yes,
more Americans are not taking a stand.
Yeah, it's disturbing. It's really disturbing. Joe Sixpack, you can't wake him up for anything. That's the Joe Sixpack only cares about his wrestling show on I think on Saturday night, or I forget when it is, and these forms of entertainment and his six pack of beer. You can't bring him to reality.
Well, maybe we ought to get him a fluoride filter, because of course they know that fluoridated water actually tends to make people passive, and that's why they're fluoridating 67% to 68% of all of the communities in the United States.
Right, you're
this
got
is
it.
Exactly what Adolf Hitler did during the Second World War. He fluoridated the water in the occupied areas. That's what the communists did in the prison camps. If you'd like to verify that, we'd be glad to send you the pages from Dr. Cliver Swinburne's book entitled The Age of Treason, written in 1957. We're out of time. Arthur, God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us. It's been a fascinating
Thank you for having me, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to be on with you.
Well, really appreciate you being with us. And our guest has been Arthur Bernclough, Veterans for Constitutional Law. One more time, the telephone number.
631 area, 474-4261, and your calls will be answered, I promise you.
Good night, God bless. All right, so this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest has been Arthur Bernclough, and I do hope that many of you out there in the listening audience are seriously concerned about the war in Afghanistan, the war with Iraq, and in all probability, the coming war with Iran. Where is the outcry from the American people? I mean, do you honestly think that we can attack Iran, which is a nation three times the size of Iraq? Do you actually think we can attack Iran without having repercussions right here in the United States? Because I will tell you that Iran has terror cells here. They've been here since at least 1993. We have a book written in 1993 talking about the terror cells here in America, the book written by Joseph Podansky, called Target America or Attack America. And they talk in that book about the Iranian terror cells. Saddam wanted to use them. The Iranians wouldn't let them use them, but they're here. They're waiting. And I would like to suggest that everything seems to be going right according to a timeline schedule. I believe that this war, coming war with Iran, has been planned for many decades. But how would you get the American people to go along? Why, you'd have to have another incident like another Pearl Harbor. Those are the exact words that you'll find if you go to their website, newamericancentury.org, that's newamericancentury.org, and read their treatise on rebuilding America's defenses. If you don't have an access to that, we do actually have the entire information on the project for the New American Century in our Iraq the Untold Story syllabus. That's Iraq the Untold Story. Understand, we're following a timeline. We're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield, and we do hope that many of you out there will make it a point to go to our website of RadioLiberty.com and pull down our material, that you'll join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every single day, trying to make people understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And if things go as I fear that they will, why, we will be moving into financial and moral bankruptcy here in America. And when, of course, the tempo of violence increases, when there are no jobs, you saw recently hundreds of thousands of immigrant workers, illegal workers, under the control of the communists and under the control of paid organizers demonstrating peacefully in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. and other major cities. How'd you like to see them demonstrating violently in our cities as they have over in France, where they burned the cities and burned the cars? And could that happen in America? Of course it can happen in America. Everything is staged. Those rallies you saw were staged. They were financed by the Ford Foundation and by your own government. Our Congress has been giving money to LULAC and the other organizations for illegal aliens here in the United States. Why would you do something like that? Why, very simply, because there is an agenda. You want the illegal aliens here so that you can utilize them in the coming period of chaos and crisis. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our website, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, when we'll be with you once again at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.